Welcome to Ominous Ones. I'm Tara.
And I'm not Tara.
We're a true crime podcast that covers missing people, murders, and all things ominous. If you like what you hear, make sure to like and subscribe so you don't miss any episodes. This is a special episode. You know why?
Why?
Because it's our 50th.
Yay!
All right, you ready for our 50th?
I like how we even discussed that this morning, and I was like, why is this gonna be so special?
Oh, I thought you were just going along with
it. No, I forgot.
Oh, yeah, it's our 50th.
I remember now.
Good job. All right, let's get into it. Jonathan Luna was born on October 21st, 1965 in New York City by the South Bronx. Growing up, he lived in the projects by Yankee Stadium, and as he got older, he was determined to get out of that area. He was known to be a, quote, bookworm and stayed out of trouble. With his good grades, he went to Fordham University for his undergraduate degree, then he went to the University of North Carolina School of Law. So, he was pretty smart.
Law school is boring as all hell, too.
Yeah, that sounds... Like, with cool cases, I feel like I would be into it, but, like, 90% of it, I'd be like, this is super boring.
Yeah, well, and you're, like, for the majority of it, you're just sitting there learning the laws about your state. So, it wouldn't even necessarily, like, be about cases either. My aunt went to a law school, and she was like, it was the most boring thing in the world. Don't ever do it.
One of the best classes I ever took was for criminal justice, though.
Really?
Yeah, I feel like I should have stayed with that. It was super interesting.
Yeah, I was like, joke's on you. I'm not going to get any education.
Sucker.
Not even high school.
Well, same. So, on August 29th, 1993, Jonathan met Angela Hopkins, who was an obstetrician in North Carolina. They went on to get married and have two sons together. I couldn't really find much about, like, more of his backstory or hers or anything. They're just like, well, they got married and had two kids, and she was a doctor.
What kind of doctor is that?
I have no idea. I didn't go to school. We just talked about this.
I feel like I've heard that before, that specialty, but I have no idea what it is.
You want to look it up?
Yeah, that's what I was just going to do.
Okay, I'll keep talking.
Okay.
After he was done in school, also in 1993, he worked at Arnold and Porter in Washington, D.C., and then he worked for the Federal Trade Commission in 1994. After that, he was a prosecutor in Brooklyn and New York City.
I should have known that. An obstetrician, or whatever you said, is a doctor that does childbirth.
Yeah, you should have
known that. Your OB. Yeah, I just had a baby. I've only heard it broken down into two letters, OB. So.
Well, I have no idea about any of that, so that's on you.
That is on me.
So
I was like, God, that's so familiar. Why do I know what that is? That's why. Okay.
So he was working for the Federal Trade Commission in 1994, and after that he was a prosecutor in Brooklyn, and then he became an assistant DA. I saw the DA job started in either 1997 or 1999. I think it was 1999, but we're going to focus on 2003 anyway. So it doesn't really matter. While working this last job as assistant DA, he was prosecuting armed robbers, child molesters, drug dealers, violent criminals, and major cases like that. It was estimated that he had worked around 80 cases. 2 years in, he got a new boss. This was possibly in 2001. The two didn't really get along. His new boss was Thomas.
So 80 cases total or in the first 2 years?
I think as assistant DA, he'd worked around 80. I think. I'm not sure.
That's a big caseload, I feel like. That sounds like a lot to me. Because one case is, it's not just like over in a day. You know what I mean? Like, you have to get all of the facts and all of your legal documents written up and all of that shit.
Well, in 2 years, if the timeline I found is correct, I don't know, in 2 years, I could see 80 of them.
That's a lot of work.
Well, and in New York as assistant DA.
Yeah, that's a lot of work.
There's a lot going on there. His new boss was Thomas DiBaggio? DiBaggio? I don't know. Thomas. They had.
You're not going to say it like that lady?
No.
With an accent?
No. Do you want to try?
Lame.
Here you go.
I can't see that far. De Blasio.
There you go. They had disagreements on a few cases, and I'm not sure when, but Thomas had given Jonathan a work review that wasn't good and was allegedly trying to fire him. One time he supposedly told Jonathan to not even show up the next day, but Jonathan was fighting back and got a lawyer. After that, Thomas seemed to calm down a little and Jonathan kept his job, but I'm like, that tension wasn't just going to go away. One of
That'd be awkward.
Yeah, I'm like, well, would you really, like, I get assistant DA in New York is probably, like, a hard job to get, but would you really want to go in every day and not get along with your boss? Seems.
They're like, don't come back. I hate you. And he's like, joke's on you. I'm coming back every day.
See you in the morning.
That would be so uncomfortable. I'd be like, all right, bye.
Yeah, I don't think I could put up with that. One of the cases that Jonathan was working on was against a rapper named Dion Smith and someone that worked with Dion named Walter O. Poindexter. Poindexter? Quite a name.
Hmm.
It was alleged that there were drugs being sold out of their recording studio named Stash House Records, which I'm like, if you're allegedly going to be selling drugs out of somewhere, maybe don't call it Stash House.
That's what I was just going to say.
Kind of like that.
Perfect name for a stash house.
What a good look. Allegedly, the case was happening because Warren Grace, a drug dealer from Baltimore, was giving the cops evidence against the two. It later came out that allegedly the FBI was looking the other way about stuff Warren was doing to keep this evidence coming into them. Warren was even going to testify against the two, but the allegations came out that the FBI wasn't making him follow the rules, which was bad for Jonathan's case because that would mean he would lose his witness. He was aware of all of that, so he wanted a plea deal to happen with the defense before everything just fell apart.
Jesus.
They both ended up pleading guilty to different crimes and were both in jail at the time of the incident I'm about to get into. Before the drug case I just talked about, there was another significant case Jonathan was working, and it was about a bank robbery. The defendant was, I think you pronounce it Naco Brown. It's N-A-C-O-E. Jonathan thought it would be an easy case, and along with his co-prosecutor, they thought they had enough evidence to get Brown put in jail for at least 25 years. One reason they thought they had it covered was some money that was found in Brown's apartment in a safe. The money was brought into the courtroom and was sealed in clear bags. After Brown was convicted on September 26, 2002, one bag of the money went missing, and it had about $36,000 in it.
Jesus.
Jonathan was a suspect in the missing money, but I'll get into that later. A week before this next part, Jonathan told a coworker that he was thinking about, quote, going out on his own, in reference to his job. This was thought because of his differences with his boss, Thomas.
So, like, starting his own firm?
Yeah. He was also in a little trouble with a judge presiding over his current case who fined him $25 for showing up late to court previously. With all of that and the missing money, people knew Jonathan was stressed and worried about his job and was trying to figure out what he was going to do next. Now we get into the incident. On December 4th of 2003, Jonathan left a voicemail for a defense lawyer on a case he was working on that was going to court the next morning. This lawyer said, quote, he told me that he had worked on the plea in his office and had to go home. He said once he got home, he would return, or he would work on the agreement so that it was ready in the morning. I think he said he would return to the office, unquote. I believe that case was the drug case because it was said he stayed late in his office trying to work on the plea deal, but I'm not sure which one he was working on. At 11:38 p.m. the same night, Jonathan left work at the courthouse and headed northeast on I-95. He had a fast pass for tolls, so we kind of know where he went. It was used on the I-95 going into Delaware. He went through three tolls with the fast pass and paid cash for the rest for some reason. $200 was taken out of his account at 12:57 a.m. This was at an ATM by Newark, Delaware at the JFK Plaza. At 2:47 a.m., Jonathan went over the Delaware River going through a toll at the Pennsylvania Turnpike. He didn't use his fast pass for this toll. They know because they found a receipt in the car from Jonathan or someone who had paid cash for it. At 3:20 a.m., Jonathan's debit card was used for gas and I think drinks at just some random gas station. After that, his car got off on the turnpike at the Reading-Lancaster interchange at 4:04 a.m. This was a toll he again paid cash for and didn't use his fast pass. The ticket was later found in his car, like the last one was.
That's wild. I'm like, why is he out that late? But somebody probably killed him and is driving his car now that they're not using the fast pass.
I mean, would you worry about the fast pass, though? Like, you're driving his car and you're going through a toll that's going to have cameras anyway. I'm like, wouldn't you just use it?
Not if they didn't know that he had it.
It's just a sticker on the windshield, isn't it? I'm like, you'd see it. I think. I could be wrong.
I have no idea.
I think it's just like the car wash stickers.
Is it?
The like little barcode. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, because we've taken them out of cars at work. And it's just like a little sticker. And then when you go through, it just like charges it.
Scans it to that account or whatever.
Yeah, I feel like you'd just use it, but I don't know. From about 4 a.m. to 5 a.m., no one is sure where exactly he was or what happened. Around 5 or 5:30 a.m. on December 5th, so the next day, an employee of Sensing and Weaver got to work approximately 95 miles away from Jonathan's office. Half an hour later, Daniel, along with another coworker, saw a silver Honda Accord nearby. It had its lights turned off, and the front of it kind of was in a nearby creek by Dry Tavern Road in Lancaster County. The creek had an approximately 4-foot tall bank, and the two front wheels were on it. Daniel saw blood above the driver door on the front driver's side and on the driver's seat. Daniel noticed the dash lights were on, as was the car. It was just idling and wasn't damaged accident-wise. It was just like kind of stuck over this wall. Jonathan was found laying face down in the creek underneath the car, under the engine specifically.
Jesus.
He was still wearing his suit with his coat on and his court ID was around his neck. More blood was found on the floorboard of the back seat, enough for it to be called a puddle.
Could you imagine being an assistant district attorney in New York City or cruising a Honda Accord?
I love that that's what you took from this, but I mean, true.
I mean, also, could you imagine being stuck under your car, under the engine block? Like, that would be
with your car stuck over a little wall in a creek?
Yeah.
He also had 36 stab wounds in his neck and chest, and he had head trauma.
Accidental.
Yeah.
He had a stroke.
Absolutely. He had all those stab wounds, but his cause of death was, what do you think?
Natural causes.
Drowning.
Oh.
They later figured out he had been stabbed with his own pocket knife. The $200, I would assume the money from the ATM, was found laying around the car, like outside of it, but just randomly like thrown around. At 8:05 a.m. was when he was pronounced dead from drowning. They later found that his...
I mean, a pocket knife may not have done enough damage to kill him, but like he lost enough blood and was weak and was unconscious from being crushed by the car, whatever. And then when he was trying to breathe, it was the drowning that actually killed him. This is not natural causes.
I mean, it's pretty wild.
It's accidental.
They later found that his cell phone and glasses were left in his office, which was weird because he needed his glasses to drive.
Suicide.
The whole drive was about 205 miles, and if you drove it straight through, it would take about 4 hours. Before, I said that his car was found 95 miles from his office, which it was, but if you look at the route he was on, he went north, east, and then cut over west, but there were faster routes to that specific point if you wanted to do that. So I'm like, instead of just being like, oh, I'm gonna go right here, he like loops all the way around. The FBI think it was a suicide because he was alone when he left his office and there wasn't much proof of anyone being with him.
So he stabbed himself 30 times and then jumped underneath his car and drowned.
They said some of the stab wounds were superficial or possibly hesitation wounds, so they thought he might have done it to himself. In the first report, they also didn't find substantial defensive wounds on his hands like they expect to find if someone is fighting someone with a knife off.
But if you're going to unalive yourself, why would you stab yourself?
I'll tell you in a second. In a different report, I saw that he definitely had defensive wounds on his hands and wrists. So there's like conflicting reports on what he had. He also had what was thought to be fingernail marks around his wrists, like someone grabbed him really hard. So I'm like, there's some of the reports are like, no, he was fine besides the 36 stab wounds. And the rest of them are like, oh, it looked like someone was really rough with him.
I don't know. Judging from what I've heard already with the shady district attorney's office, I'm going to vote that they paid somebody off for them to be like, oh, this was accidental and he committed suicide. This was not a murder.
So they have possible motives for suicide. Jonathan was supposed to be taking a polygraph for the missing $36,000 I mentioned earlier. To get into that, he was not the one in charge of the money. The U.S. Attorney's office was, so it would have been difficult for him to steal it, like he wasn't the one moving it or anything. A few people admitted that the money was not attended to the entire time, so it was possible for more than just him to walk off with it. But not many thought that he would. They were like, that just wasn't the kind of person he was. They found that he had a secret credit card his wife supposedly didn't know about, and it had about $25,000 of debt on it.
Jesus.
Some sites say that he was signed up for a dating site, but some say that he did have one, but the profile was like 7 years old, and that he wasn't on there. So I'm like, I don't know. There's so many like conflicting things with this one. Some believe that Jonathan had a fake... This is why they think that he might have stabbed himself. Some believe that Jonathan had a fake kidnapping plan, but he accidentally unalived himself when he went too far with it. So he's gonna be like, oh, I was kidnapped and they did this, and then was like superficially hurting himself, and then one of them ended up doing a lot of damage.
I'm not buying that at all.
Oh, me neither, but that's just one of the theories. One federal investigator thought he stabbed himself and did it just for sympathy from his boss and the other people causing stress in his life, and they think that one stab wound accidentally hit his carotid artery, and that would have killed him if he wouldn't have drowned first. He's like, oh, if I'm a stab victim, everyone will feel so sorry for me. All the stress will just go away.
36 times.
Yeah, that's quite a lot.
That's a lot. If I was going to stab myself for attention, it wouldn't be 36 times and it wouldn't be anywhere near one of my arteries.
Facts. On the other side of this, people say that between his job and his wife's, they made enough money to make up the debts and suicide wouldn't have been necessary. As for the dating site and the hidden debt, it didn't seem like enough for him to do it. Like, even his wife was like, well, not, like, it sucks he was $25,000 in debt, but like, we would have been okay. We couldn't
handle.
As far as anyone can tell, he had a good marriage, and while it might have been a fight, like I was saying about the debt, she was like, it's okay, though, like, we could have handled that. And I'm like, she was a doctor, which he might have been driving around in a Honda, but I feel like at least she would have been making good money.
Yeah.
And it's not like he didn't have a job anymore. The local cops don't agree with suicide, and neither do two coroners who worked the case. They ruled it the homicide.
Also, why is everybody, like, pitching in of, oh, he did this and then hit his carotid artery on accident and this and that, when you're not even a coroner, a forensic scientist, or anything? Like, you're just making a dumbass statement.
Well, they had two coroners. The FBI is like, suicide, and the local cops are like, no, it's homicide.
Yeah, but the two coroners are the ones that are not saying that it was a suicide, right?
Right. But I feel like they just gave them the facts and the FBI was like, sounds like a suicide.
Yeah. And the other people that are like, oh, well, he was just doing it for attention. Like, that's just a dumbass statement you made when you have no idea where the stab wounds were at or how deep they were, because you are not in that position.
I mean, they might have read a report, but I still think if I'm going to listen to anyone on a case, it's the coroner.
Yeah, facts.
Some evidence that he was killed was the fact that he left his phone and glasses in his office because he needed his glasses to drive, so it's possible he wasn't driving the car at all, especially with the distance he drove. So I'm like, it's not like he was like, oh, I'm just going down the street, I can do it without my glasses. Like, he drove, what did I say, like 200 miles?
You and I both wear glasses. Can you imagine getting in your car and driving without them?
No.
My eyes are so bad. Like, I would kill how many people?
Like, I've broken my glasses before and been like, I can't drive.
Facts.
So, yeah, they're like, there's no way that he would have done that. The blood in the back seat, they think, means someone was driving while he was bleeding back there. For the homicide theory, there was the blood found on the toll ticket. I forgot to mention that earlier. On one of the toll tickets, there was blood on it. So they were like, was he hurt beforehand? They were driving through the toll. He touched the receipt for some reason. They get to the creek, and then he was drowned, or accidentally drowned, whatever you want to go with. So he was bleeding before they got there. Some more of the evidence found that says someone was with him was a blood type that wasn't his, was found with a partial print that wasn't his.
Mm.
So I'm like, oh, it'd be weird to have someone else's blood in your car with a fingerprint on it that's not related to being stabbed 36 times.
And then you did it to yourself.
There was...
That person just stood by and watched, and then was like, you know what, this is too much for me. You've had enough attention for the night, and took off. Didn't report it, though.
Facts. There was video of him from the gas station, and it appeared like he was talking to someone, but they stayed out of frame. So they're like, we're not sure if it was just someone at the gas station, someone with him, or what, but it did look like he was talking to someone. I also read that when he was at the gas station, he purchased several drinks, which some say means that he could have been buying it for two people. But I'm like, I don't know about that. I go to the store and buy a bunch of drinks at once just for me.
That's facts.
I do think someone was with him, though.
I do, too.
But that's not evidence for me.
Did they check the tolls cameras?
They must have.
And they couldn't see another person in the vehicle, I guess, at night. And if the windows are tinted on his Honda, because he doesn't want to be seen as an assistant DA driving around an Accord.
You're really stuck on this Accord.
Yeah. I'm appalled at his behavior.
Fair. A private investigator and a lawyer were hired by Jonathan's family, and they filed a writ of mandamus, I don't know Latin, meaning the cops would be forced into doing an inquest into Jonathan's death. They had asked this to be done previously, but were told no. I believe it worked this time, but this is another one where it's like super conflicting, how they're like, yeah, the inquest definitely happened, and the other place are like, no, they were just told no again. So, believe what you will. William Buckingham, a private investigator who worked the case, said, quote, I know who sanctioned it, who did it, and who was behind the hit. If I know it, why don't state police know it, unquote. Which I'm like, you're going to say all that? You're not going to say who did it?
I was just going to say that.
He also thinks someone took Jonathan from the courthouse and that two cars were involved. Jonathan's he was found under and another one that the killer or killers used to leave. But he never came out with any names. He was just like, yeah, I definitely know who did it. I can't believe the dumb cops can't figure it out. And I'm not going to tell them. I'm
telling, though. Keeping my secrets.
And the private investigator was hired.
Must have stunk that night.
The private investigators were hired by the family. So I'm like, you're not going to tell the family who it was?
What?
There was speculation about Dion and Walter being involved. The two from the drug case. When people questioned if the two were involved, Dion's attorney said, quote, Mr. Luna was instrumental in negotiating the deal and convincing his office that it was a proper deal. So both men had the deal they sought from the prosecution, unquote. They were also in jail when it happened. February.
Doesn't mean they couldn't have somebody do it, though.
But they were like, we came to a good deal with him. Like, they weren't upset with him. Like, he didn't really, like, fuck them over. So they were like, why would we do that? In February of 2020, a newspaper requested that the coroner's office unseal records about his death. They also thought it was weird that the records were in the county's possession and not with the federal prosecutors. Judge David Ashworth on January 13th in 2021 ruled that all the records would stay sealed because he thought it would compromise the case to have them unsealed, and said the autopsy shouldn't be released because there are aspects of it that if someone says something specific about it later, then it's going to prove they were there. I think that that's why so much of it is conflicting, is because so much of it is still sealed. And I think people are just, like, guessing on, like, defensive wounds or not. And
yeah,
there is currently a $100,000 reward for information leading to a conviction. And as for what his wife thinks, she has never spoken publicly about it.
Jesus.
The FBI still says he was alone. So at this point, it seems like the local coroner says homicide and the FBI says suicide and no one knows. Except for the PI, but he's not going to give you any names.
He's not going to tell. Snitches get stitches, Tara. You know what it was, is he found it out. It's somebody so high up that he's like, yeah, I'm not putting my life on the line for this one freaking $10,000 job, $5,000 job, however much the family paid him.
I just don't know who would have cared enough to put a hit on him or kill him. I mean, I guess being...
He had 80 cases in the Bronx. He probably dealt with some pretty...
I was going to say, he probably made a lot of enemies, but I don't know. I'm like, they got away with it. So someone was good at it. So whoever did it or was hired wasn't a newbie, it seems like. Was
he missing any case files? Because if they picked him up in his office, you'd think they'd be like, grab my case file. We're lighting that motherfucker on fire.
Well, I'm sure all that's sealed. You can't even see his autopsy or anything. So I feel like they're like, we're the DA and we're not going to tell you what we are or aren't missing.
True.
Well, that was the case of Jonathan Luna, and it was our 50th.
Happy 50th.
So here's to 500 more.
We just celebrated 50 years of friendship too, remember?
That's true. A lot of 50s. Well, here's to 500. Thanks for listening. Make sure you follow us on social media. And
like and subscribe.
And we'll talk to you guys next time.
Bye.